Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fuck guys? What's going on? How's it going? Where are we at? What is that? What is that? What is that? What do I hear? Holy shit. What is that? That sounds fucking great. Wait, is that old ZZ Top? I think it is. ZZ Top, Billy Gibbons on the show today. Some of you might be like, really, ZZ Top? Well, you know who you are? You grew up too fucking late, man. I'm talking pre-beard shit, folks. I'm talking the first 4, 5, 6, even 7 records. I couldn't be more excited. I'm going to set something up, and I don't usually do it. But Billy sat in here after we talked with a cigar box resonator guitar and played a Rye Cooter interpretation of a traditional song, Billy the Kid, that I couldn't fucking believe it was happening. I told Jack White about it. Yeah, I'm dropping names left and right today, I guess. By the way, I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. I'm sorry. You know, obviously I got beside myself, got a little excited. I mean, come on, man. I got a big place in my heart for the ZZ Top, and I get to talk to Billy Gibbons. I'm going to share it with you. So I run into Jack White. I brought this up in the pre-show ad, and you know, he recognized me, and, you know, it was kind of a big deal to me. Is that ridiculous? He's, you know, Jack's great, and I told him I talked to Billy, and I told him about this song that Billy plays at the end of this. I so want to get Jack that song. I think Billy Gibbons should do a whole fucking album like that, man. I don't know what we got to do. I don't know what we got to do to get him to do it. But I do want to tell you that ZZ Top is now is touring Europe, and they're going to be back in the States next month. You can go to ZZTop.com for the full tour brochure. What's going on, man? I was just in Chicago, and I got to say, despite all my panic and attempts at destroying my confidence alone, I had a great show, man. And I want to thank everybody that came out to the Athenaeum. Is that how you pronounce it? That theater sold it out. Me and Adam Burke laid one out, did a nice hour and a half show. He did like 20. Nice 2-hour package. Pow! Look out. Just shit my pants. JustCoffee.coop. That's a classic plug from Mark Maron, who was sitting right here talking about himself in the third person. So, okay, look, here's what happened. So I go to Chicago. Now, you know, some of you were with me throughout the process of building the hour. You know, and I was not that confident about it. But the thing about me is I don't seem to realize that I've spent more than half my life on stage, and that what really needs to happen is I just need to show up and be present and be open and be, you know, ready to engage and be me on stage and see what happens. I'd rather that happen. I'd rather have no material at all. I'd rather just make something happen out of thin air that's never happened before. But when I play a big theater, and we sold that thing out, man, like 950 seats in Chicago. So I was like, wow, we sold out. And then there's that part of me that's like, do you even deserve to sell out? And then I'm sort of like, you know, shut up, dude. And then he's like, no, seriously. I mean, do you really think you've got the juice for this? And then I go through this whole weird sort of deconstruction process of who I am and what I do. And I'm tired of it. Jesus fucking Christ, man. I'm 50 years old. I've been doing this most of my life. Why does that got to be my process? Why does my process have to be, I don't know if I can do this? And I ended up at Eataly. I'm just sitting there like, I'm fucked there. How am I going to, you know, I'm going to disappoint 950 people. And I'm just like, I've decided that I'm no good. I'm not funny. I got no right. And I'm just looking at some guy looking at pastry. He's just looking at it. He's just looking in the case. He's bent over, and there's this look on his face, and he's just having this weird, it's not even weird. It was pure. It was beautiful. He's just having this, you know, this longing relationship with one of the pastries in the case. And it was so pure. It was like, it's just pure desire. It's just that guy looking at what he wants to put in his mouth. There's nothing dirty about it. There's it's primal, you know, that's not fetishized. So I noticed that, and then a woman walks up, and she starts looking in the case, and now they're both looking at pastries with just the honest, pure desire of wanting a pastry and making a decision. And then I start looking at the woman's ass, and I realize, like, that's not a lot different, the feeling I'm feeling. These are pure human feelings. I'm looking at her ass, and they're looking at pastries. Yeah, I think that pastries are a little purer because you don't, you know, You're not thinking about putting the pastries elsewhere or whatever. But I just started to tap into these kind of primal desires. Like, look, I'm just, this is passive. Yeah, I'm not, you know, I'm not like, I got to meet her or nothing. It's just like, it's what my brain does. And it's sort of, I locked into that and I realized, like, this is what people do, man. They want to eat and they want to fuck and they don't want to die. And for some reason, I thought that was a great grounding realization. And I felt better about everything. And then I somehow pulled it together. I was just looking for some reason, something to hang my failure on. And then this kid, Liam Cunningham, he's a friend of the guy who booked the thing. And he was driving me around. You know, that was his gig, was driving me around. And he plays guitar with Jeff Tweedy sometimes on the road and stuff. And he's a sweet guy. And we get to the, he drives me to the theater and there's two guitars in there. He's a guitar player. There's a little record player there. And he's like, hey, they told me that you wanted to, you like playing guitar. And I'm like, holy shit, this is the best. So I just sat in my dressing room in this old theater, jamming some blues, listening to him play some ragtime guitar, relaxed. Before I went on stage, all I was thinking was, dude, you just got to be present. Just because it's a big room doesn't mean you have to be as big as the room. The only difference between a big room and a small room is the size of the room. Make the room come to you. Make the room come to you. Just be present. Riff it out, bro. Riff it out. Just go through your day, talk about where you're at, and nail that shit. That's what you do. You make it happen in that moment. That's the moment you're looking for. Hey, this is never going to happen again. It's coming out of my mouth. Make that happen. So I wrangled all my powers. I was driven by the blues. Thank you, Liam, for those guitars. God damn it. That helped out. And we went out there and did it, man. We did it. I got to tell you, man, I'm tired of that cycle. There's got to be another way. There's got to be another way. For me to, you know, to prepare and just be like, hey, how about let's go out there and kill and have a good time? How about that? Why don't you try that one? All right. Let's talk to Billy Gibbons, man. The Buddha. Billy Gibbons. I learned how to play guitar from you.
Awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't realize it until recently because I've been playing a lot because my, you know, I'm out of a relationship and I find that's when you're supposed to pick up the guitar and feel what's necessary to feel.
Yeah.
But where'd you get it?
Well, the BFG story, Billy F. Gibbons picked up a guitar on Christmas Day. I'd turned 13, December 16.
Yeah.
No guitar.
Right.
9 days later, under the tree, there it is.
What kind?
Gibson Melody Maker with a Fender Champ amp.
That's the amp.
And that's the way to go.
Yeah.
And it's been downhill ever since.
So what were you listening to, though? What was moving you? I mean, you come from a musical family. How did you get going?
Yeah. My dear dad was an entertainer. He was a keyboardist. He did all kinds of things. He came from an interesting background. Five brothers. Their dad, my granddad, was a glove maker from England.
Okay.
And they came over in 1906. And my dad was the youngest. And one day, I said, how did this entertainment thing get started? And he said, well, I said, me and my brothers went down for lunch at the glove factory, and when we left, we said, we need to think of something quick. We ain't doing this. They all learned how to play instruments, and they started the Gibbons Brothers Band.
What was it, big band?
Well, they started off as the Jazzy Five.
Right.
And that was kind of a swing and ragtime group, which...
And what'd your dad play, piano?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So they were the Jazzy Five.
And then they later got tuxedoed out and became legit. They were so good, they wound up landing a lot of the contracts up there at Lake George, Saratoga Springs, all those gangster hideouts.
Sure. Just doing dance music?
Yeah.
Like swing?
Pretty much. Yeah. And then you know, the legit stuff of the day.
Right.
And
kind of a cover band.
I would, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they wrote stuff. And there was another glove maker in Gloversville. That was upstate New York. Gloversville. They make gloves.
This was in New York. This was happening.
Yeah.
Well, how did you end up in Texas?
Well, there was a guy out of Manhattan, and this was pre-Warren Harding Act when they broke up the monopolies. If you had a Warner picture, you showed it in a Warner theater.
Right.
You had a Lowe's picture, it had to be in a Lowe's house.
Okay.
And this guy in New York, Will Horowitz, was dispatched down to Houston to build some Lowe's theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a daughter, and back in those days, those are the 20s.
Yeah.
And at that time, if you wanted a classic summer holiday, you went up Niagara Falls and all that Catskill, Adirondack stuff. And she fell for my dad. So they got married, had a little baby girl, and one day a guy came and said, my dad was Frederick Gibbons.
Yeah.
And he said, Freddie, he said, we're going to California. We got a new business starting. This was Samuel Goldfish, glove maker.
Mm-hmm.
He later changed his name to Samuel Goldwyn.
Oh, really? He was a glove maker.
And they went to California. In fact, the house I live in was... That was my dad's pad. This is interesting because Iris Horowitz, later knee Iris Gibbons, my dad's first wife, and their daughter, she fell victim to some strange malady. And when the handwriting was on the wall, her days were numbered. She wanted to go back to Texas. She wanted to go to Houston, be with her dad.
Uh-huh.
My dad said, fine. He was at MGM.
Doing what?
Music director.
Really?
There was a bunch of them.
For pictures? One of them.
Yeah.
I said pictures because that's what they were called then.
The pictures.
Yeah.
In fact, his second cousin was Cedric Gibbons, the great art director, married to Dolores Del Rio. And
so you come from a show business family in a way.
Yeah, yeah. And I found, when I braved the question, how did my dad get into this entertainment game, he finally... let the cat out of the bag. He was a little skeptical because he knew I was leaning toward this rock thing.
Yeah.
And he was more legit
right
this time.
Yeah.
But Iris passed away, and well, they left California in about 43 or 44.
Mm-hmm.
And then she passed away. But by this time my dad was ensconced in Houston.
Right.
And fortunately, he met my mother. So there it is.
And she's from Texas?
Ireland.
Really?
English dad, Irish mother. The war is going on right here. Right down below.
That's where the blues come from.
The fire is...
Celtic blues.
Yeah, yeah.
She was Irish with an Irish accent even?
Lorraine Duffy. No, she was not quite the brogue had kind of...
Right.
I don't know if it was ever there, but nonetheless... it was good. Redheaded, mean Irish mother.
Uh-huh. And your half-sister was living in the old house out here?
Yes.
Okay.
She said, hey, you want a house in Hollywood? And I said, oh, I thought she was joking.
Yeah, and you took it.
So I said, okay. She said, well, your sister doesn't want it, and my kids don't want it. I said, well, what are you talking about? Because my mom had this strict edict. She said, now look. The first chapter is now closed. We're starting chapter two.
Don't even talk to them.
But the half-sister, she started peeling the onion, and then my mother softened up, and she said, okay, here's the whole story.
Well, it's interesting. So you're in that house that was part of your dad's life in another life. And I was always sort of hung up on this idea that you have some sort of, you believe in the magic of the past, do you? I mean, didn't you make a guitar at a Muddy Waters house?
Exactly. Yeah.
See, that when I heard about that, and that was the guitar, it was like, was it a rectangle with the Delta River with the Mississippi on it?
Yes.
But was when you made that guitar, did you count on there being some magic in it?
We knew that there would be. I had a buddy, Tony Fortune, who was acting as a sales agent for his family's company. They were the distribution agent for Taylor Frozen Drink Machines.
Okay.
And he was dispatched to go from Memphis all the way down through Mississippi. He called me up and he said, when you guys are in the studio, generally the Saturday, Sundays are, you know, let's get our batteries recharged.
He
said, I was coming back into Memphis and I was going through Clarksdale, Mississippi, and I saw a little tiny sign that said Blues Museum.
Yeah.
He said, do you know anything about it? I said, no, maybe we should go So sure enough, we drove from Memphis down to Clarksdale, and we almost ran out of luck.
Uh-huh.
But the last question, do you know that? Oh, Blues Museum, that's part of the city library.
So no one knew where it was?
One guy.
Right.
And he ran a gas station. He was a blues fan.
Right.
And he thought that this was kind of novel because the blues was, I wouldn't say enjoying its popular the popular status that we know now.
Yeah. Does it ever? I mean, it's been a long time since you guys had to reinvent the blues for it to gain popularity, I think.
Yeah, it comes and goes.
Right.
You know, and every so often, the blues. Oh,
right,
yeah.
Right.
We met Sid Graves, who was the curator. That was his kind of his baby, hobby thing. Jim O'Neill, who was the founder of Living Blues Magazine, was also present.
Now, what did they have in this place? How big was it?
It was one room upstairs, and it was actually very fine. You could feel the dedication that had surrounded the mm-hmm. establishment. But they were there talking about their concern, the house that Muddy Waters grew up in.
McKinley Morganfield.
Was on Stovall. Well, back then it was Stovall Plantation. They've changed the name. And it had been struck by a high wind, and the highway department was threatening to tear it down as a safety hazard or something. So here was Sid Graves, and they said, "You want to go? Let's go check." I said, "Heck yeah." So
yeah.
Jumped in the car, drove down the way, and we were walking around under the trees, and there was this cabin. And off to the side was this pile of refuse where the roof had kind of fallen in.
Okay.
We said, okay, great, right? And both Sid and Jim said, "Well, here, don't you want a souvenir? You got to take something from Muddy Waters' house."
Right.
And here was this roof timber.
Uh-huh.
Which we loaded in the trunk of the car. And on the way back to Memphis, we said, "Well, what are you going to do with this?" I said, "Wow." I said, we could saw it into planks, glue it together, and cut up a guitar and make something out of it.
Yeah.
"What's your guitar made of?" Muddy Waters' house.
Okay. So you did it.
And it was, we donated it. Rick Rayburn from Pyramid Guitars there in Memphis was actually the fabricator.
Uh-huh.
And not only did it play good, it sounded great. And it was a real tough call to let it go. But we thought, gee, what a offering.
Where is it now?
It down. It's in the Delta Blues Museum.
It's right there. It's in that little place.
In Clarksdale.
Did you play that thing on anything?
We did. We played it on, I think we played that on DeGuayo. Was 1980. It was our first record for Warner Brothers.
That, you know, I just listened to that record yesterday. You know, like, I've been listening, like, I had the first five albums all my life, it feels like.
Okay.
And I hadn't listened to DeGuayo in a while, and that's a great fucking record.
I like it.
I mean, why did it take you so long to record Dust My Broom? Did you ever, like, consider that? I mean, you've been playing blues for your whole life.
Well, it was so predictable, in our opinion.
Right.
We just kind of overlooked that stuff.
But you found a different groove in it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
When it finally happened, and of course, you mentioned Terry Manning, the engineer, John Fry, the owner of Ardent, Joe Hardy, and John Hampton. Those were the four key players that made Memphis our second home.
Okay.
And
and that's where you recorded DeGuayo?
Yes. And well, we recorded everything from Trace Ombre's onward.
There.
Up until, about 1996, Rhythmine was the first. We built a mirror image studio in Houston.
Okay.
So we knew we had a place in Memphis. Now we had a fallback in Houston.
Yeah.
And
That's where you did Rhythmine in Houston?
Yeah.
In the Replica Studio?
Started there.
And that was sort of the return to the original sound.
Yes.
That was an intentional transition out of the three or four record period of spinning guitars and beards and syncopated drumming.
Oh, yeah. All of the... We had the opportunity to do just that, return to a more earthy and kind of early style.
Dirty.
But it was Terry Manning and Hardy and the whole Ardent team.
Yeah.
We woke up and they said, you know, we've never, we were not necessarily a purist blues band by any stretch. We were more of realists, I guess, interpreters.
Well, the weird thing to me, like you, from the very first album, you know, found this very unique groove to the blues that was really your own. I mean, you know, you sort of figured out some weird, that drive that comes a little from John Lee Hooker, but some other groove that, you know, you're not afraid to stand on a chord for a while.
Indeed.
But like, it's so you reinvented the fucking music that in redefined it, I think, from the very beginning, and that just happened naturally.
Well, Dusty Hill, the bass player in ZZ Top, yeah. Frank Beard, our percussionist,
sure.
The man with no beard.
Yeah.
They grew up listening to about the same kind of stuff that I was into.
Who was it?
Well, it was, of course, the famous station from across the border of
Mexico, Del Rio,
XERF.
And you wrote a song, Heard It
on the X.
Yeah.
But those late night sessions, you know, you're sitting there with the transistor radio under the pillow and you're hearing all of that great, great blues stuff. We followed the Rolling Stones intimately.
Yeah.
And I think it would be fair to say that the British guys who wound up taking all the unwanted blues records kind of salvaged it. This was a rapidly evaporating art form.
Right.
Thanks to the onslaught of what came out of the UK, it was returning.
Right.
And then, of course, Eric Clapton came along and tore it up, followed with Peter Green.
Peter Green's the guy, right?
Mick Taylor. So many guys. Mick Abrams.
But you were listening to them and the old stuff?
Yeah.
The source material? Because a lot of those guys, I mean, like the Stones blues was a little hopped up and kind of pure. But then Peter Green, I don't know where that guy came from. I don't know where his sound comes from. I mean, like, it is some of the saddest shit I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah, he, the expressiveness that emanated from not only his guitar playing, but his singing.
Oh, I know, man.
Which is the tough part of it.
Man of the world?
Oh, yeah.
What?
And I recently appeared in Hawaii with Willie Kay on guitar, Mick Fleetwood was on drums.
What a drummer, man.
Oh, and, you know, getting up on stage was the easy part.
Yeah.
The hard part was curtailing the hours upon hours of stories.
Oh, really?
Of back then. And, you know, Peter Green, to this day, Mick Fleetwood considers him leader of the charge.
Right.
And so be it. The guy is... I listen to it daily.
So what was the first band? Yours?
The Saints.
Yeah.
Which we were 13.
Uh-huh.
This was about 6 months of, you know, woodshedding in the bedroom.
Yeah.
And, although Christmas Day, by the end of the, right before midnight, I was stuck on that thing and I learned the Jimmy Reed chords.
Yeah.
That little, you know, turnaround boogie.
Yep.
And the opening four notes to Ray Charles' What'd I Say?
Right. It's all you need, right?
And that's it. That started it.
And then you get your pentatonic scales later and you're done.
You're done.
So the Saints. So you were in junior high.
Yeah. Three guitars and drums.
Three guitars, no bass.
No.
No, just guitars.
Yeah.
Whoever was, played.
David Croswell on one guitar, myself, Philip Taft on guitar, and Steve Mickley holding down the percussion end of things. And
any of those guys stick with it?
Yeah, we still stay in touch. They've gone on to different things, but they woodshed all the time.
Uh-huh.
We have threatened to get it back together.
The Saints.
The trouble is, our first paying gig was in Mickley's yard, playing for a car wash, being washed in the driveway.
Right. Yeah,
people go to the, you know, they pay and, you know, they drive through the automatic wash these days. But we're threatening.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Maybe another.
So that was part of the pitch. You got live blues music and you get your car wash.
Yeah. In fact, here we are in the garage we could go to the front. There's room. No. Not much room.
This is where men work.
Yeah, okay.
In the garage. So what was the first real band?
Well, I consider the Saints, having latched on to that distinction, the second paying gig was for a high school drinking club called Hoffa High Ronka.
Mm-hmm.
And it was founded by the seniors of the high school. We were still, I was still in junior high.
Yeah.
And Hoffa High Ronka was one of the guy, one of the members. His dad was a beer distributor, and one of the beers was Hoffman's.
Right.
And so Hoffa, for you get high and ronked on Hoffman's beer. Uh-huh. So Hoffa High Ronka. We played the party, and of course it got raided, and I remember scampering over the fence with guitar over his shoulder and trying to hang
carry
on to that
champ.
Fender champ.
Yeah.
I said, this is for me.
Yeah.
This is okay.
Yeah. Your melody maker and your champ.
Yep.
And what were you guys playing, blues?
All kinds of stuff, you know.
Just rock and roll?
The rock and roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when did you lock into a real sort of concert outfit?
From the Saints, we started a little high school band. We called it the Coachman, and it was proper with Mike Frazier on bass, and we had a nice four-piece outfit. And then the 13th Floor Elevators sprang onto the scene in about 66. They had a big record that broke out nationally called You're Gonna Miss Me.
Right.
And they turned it upside down.
Is that what, that's Rocky Erickson?
Yeah. Yeah. His voice was freak out, just maniacal scream. And Tommy Hall with these, you know, cerebral lyrics and the playing the jug. Those records, they too still hold water. We listen to those every day.
Uh-huh. Now, are you friends with Rocky?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Play on occasion. I'll take the deck with him. He recently asked me to come up, and whether he recalls that we were friends in 67.
Yeah. It's not clear.
I'm not sure.
And one might have lost a whole year or two.
Our dear girl friend in Austin, who's kind of a mover and shaker about town, she said, that was really a good performance you delivered with Rocky. I overheard him mention to one of the band members, he said, yeah, Billy is pretty good. Maybe you think we can get him in the band? So I don't know, maybe there's a chance.
So that inspired you?
Yes, we changed the name to the Moving Sidewalks.
From the Coachman.
Yes. The 13th Floor Elevators were such an influence, and we followed them diligently.
And everything was breaking open. Psychedelic music was happening.
Yeah, our first recorded work was a track called 99th Floor. So you can see the interplay.
Now, were you guys tripping and stuff?
I believe.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If there was a way to remember all of that.
It's not clear.
Man.
And you guys did a record?
We did. It was called Flash by the Moving Sidewalks. But just recently been reissued as a very handsome box set. Got a nice 50-page booklet to go along with it.
How many tracks did you do?
It's a two-disc set. They dredged up things that I had forgotten about. It was so well orchestrated. In fact, finding all of this,
I got to hear it, man.
Yeah.
Can you hear yourself in there?
Yeah.
Can you identify the what became your guitar style within that?
Yes. There's one track called Joe Blues. See, the Moving Sidewalks were hired to travel with Jimi Hendrix out of the Clear Blue.
And this is your band?
Yes.
And who hired you? Out of Texas?
1968. We were working out of Houston.
Yeah.
And the Jimi Hendrix Experience had launched this U.S. jaunt.
And you knew his stuff?
Oh, yeah. We had gotten that first RU Experience. I read about it somewhere, and I said, wow, this sounds interesting. And once you heard it, there was no turning back.
This like, that was all blues, too, though, man. He was straight up blues.
Yeah.
Right?
He did the psychedelic Turn It Inside Out.
Right.
But he never left. He always had one foot in the blues.
Right, buddy guy.
Yeah, and just did it right. He was doing things with the Fender Stratocaster guitar that I'm fairly certain the designers had no inkling of this being possible.
No one can understand how the hell he did it.
But there was a group called the Soft Machine.
Yeah,
that was. They were traveling on the bill. That was John Wyatt's group, another trio.
Uh huh.
And I got to be fairly tight with Jimi Hendrix.
And you're both, what, were you about the same age? I mean, he was like, what, 25?
He was 24. Yeah. I think I was 18, 68.
Were you guys trading licks?
Oh, yeah. He made arrangements. Chaz Chandler,
yeah,
who was the bass player for Eric Burdon's group, The Animals.
Yep.
And Chaz had put the bass guitar aside to become Jimi Hendrix's manager.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an interesting excursion because at that time there was some concern over which hotel to select that would let mixed groups
come in. Yeah.
And it was always arranged where Jimmy and I had opposing hotel rooms on either side of the hall at the very end of the hallway.
Right.
And I found out later why. Each afternoon, there were a couple guys that would bring in this piece of furniture called a record player. And this was not a little handled suitcase. This was...
the console?
The console.
The whole unit, big piece of furniture.
And
yeah.
He said, yeah, come on over, man, check this out. Well, he was studying the work of Jeff Beck, the first Jeff Beck group.
Really?
Rod Stewart on vocals and Jeff on guitar. He said, what do you think? How do you think he's doing this? Which completely blew my mind.
Really?
And I've talked to Jeff. He sits in disbelief when I tell him, yes, Jimi Hendrix was studying every Jeff Beck lick.
Because he went out there too. Like he pushed it.
Yes.
So like, and Jimmy's a guy that pushes it. So if there's a noise that's coming out of a guitar that he can't figure out, he's going to be like, oh man.
Yeah.
What is he doing? And you sat there and tried to work that shit out with him?
Yes. And of course, Jimmy's interpretation took it to another level.
Oh, really?
Jeff was already on Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jimmy said, yeah, let's go out there to meet him. I said, okay, we'll go out there.
And what were you doing when you were playing and he was playing and you would just sit there and try to work it out?
Yeah, one of the endearing exchanges was the fact I was attempting to study everything Jimi Hendrix was doing.
Right.
As he was listening to Jeff Beck, I was listening to Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
Are you experienced?
And you're just sitting there watching him play.
Oh, yeah. He'd say, well, do you know this?
And what?
I'd go, well, not yet. Come on.
What was he just trading licks? I mean, what were they?
Trading licks. And Jimi Hendrix, the Fender Stratocaster was his weapon of choice.
Right. And you're a Gibson guy.
Well, at the time, I was chasing with the Stratocaster.
Oh, you were? Okay.
And the Stratocaster has three pickups.
Right.
And there is a little toggle switch with three settings.
Right.
Front pickup all the way front.
Mm-hmm.
Middle pickup in the middle. And back pickup.
That searing lead pickup.
Well, Hendrix discovered that if you gingerly moved the toggle switch between back and middle, there was this weird in between.
It's a poppy. They make a five position switch now.
Yeah.
I love that sound. That's what Stevie Ray took.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And
but they didn't have the five-way switch then.
He invented it. Huh. He discovered
sure.
it. And then, of course, later they said, well, this is too good. We need to make this. It was not designed. It was a mistake. It was just an anomaly within that little contraption. It was spring-loaded, and early on, you had to be very careful to get it at the sweet spot.
Right.
But sometimes if you jumped around too much, the spring would pop it out of place. So then Hendrix took it apart, removed the spring so it would rest easy and not run the risk.
So he was a guy, he got into the mechanics of it.
He was an inventor.
He was
just like this, tinker.
What kind of guy was he?
Cool cat.
Nice.
Cool cat, yeah.
Just all about guitar?
Very much so.
Yeah.
Dedicated. I don't know if there could be three guys that melted into this aggregation any more stridently. They were Noel Redding, he was actually a guitarist that went to bass.
Right.
But his guitar playing skills made him a wonderful compliment on the low end.
Right.
And Mitch Mitchell is underrated as a out and out jazzer.
Yeah, he's a jazz guy. Just
all flourishes.
Over. Yeah. But, so what'd you pick up from Jimmy? Where'd you start popping those strings?
Oh, we actually had the nerve. This is when you're 18 and you don't have any sense.
Yeah.
We did a couple of Jimi Hendrix numbers
opening
the show. And he thought that was the funniest thing. He says, man, you're doing my stuff. All right. I like it. It was crazy.
Do you remember anything specific that, you know, you kind of, you know, learned from him?
There's one interesting tale
from
the time we were together. We started off in Texas, and then we went west. That's where the bookings were taking. I think it might have been in Phoenix.
Uh-huh.
And we were in the venue, kind of stuck, and it was, we couldn't leave. There was no place to go, and there was time to kill. And there was an Englishman that was helping out as he functioned as the truck driver and the roadie and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So the Soft Machine had part of their thing, they would erect a rail, a trough above the stage and behind.
Mm-hmm.
And it was filled with fluorescent liquid.
Okay.
And they would let it drip with black light. So it was raining blue.
Glowing blue.
Glowing blue as they played, and it would splash on the deck, and it was messy. And
who knew what was in it? I mean, it's horrible for you.
So this fateful night, Jimmy sent Nigel out where he found some, he went out and got these large Bahamian sponges.
Mm-hmm.
And we secured them to the end of the guitar neck with big rubber bands.
Yeah.
I said, now what are we doing? And he also sent out for some giant sheets of paper. He found a billboard supply company that had giant pieces of white that were going to become billboards.
Right.
And we hung them from the back. And he had gallon jugs of fluorescent paint, also gotten from this billboard shop. So he turned up the Marshall amps. I turned up mine, and the feedback was just... And we dunked the end of the guitar and started splashing the fluorescent paint jobs. A painting. You know, they had evacuated the audience.
Oh, so it was after the show?
Yeah, we were just hanging out. This is what he would dream this kind of stuff up.
That's wild.
It was crazy.
So how did you evolve out of, like, you know, what was, you know, a trend in music into, you know, just going back to, you know, the straight up shit? You know, when ZZ Top formed?
Well, the Sidewalks were, we moved to California. And then shortly thereafter, we were playing a couple of the joints on the Strip.
Yeah.
There was, the two famous ones, Gazzari's, which lasted the longest.
Long time.
And then next door was the Galaxy, Pandora's Box.
So this is like, what, 67?
68 into 69.
So this is crazy here. It's like, you know, everything's blown open.
Insane.
Yeah.
Sunset Boulevard on the north side of the street was... Yeah. It's two lanes going east, two lanes coming back west. The curbside lane was no longer trafficable by vehicles. People were spilling off the sidewalk in that first lane.
Just freak show.
Just, I mean, wall-to-wall people. Guys with T-shirts with a menu of acid, $5, weed.
Yeah,
it was just, you know. Every other block.
Yeah.
And the local authorities some of them were amused with it. It was
they're probably just happy. Let's just keep it contained. If we keep it within that 1 mile radius.
Yeah.
Let them have it.
One lane, 1 mile.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
But those were some crazy days. But the keyboardist and the bassist for the Moving Sidewalks were called into the military.
Oh, really?
And it left me and the drummer kind of going, well, we still want to do this. These guys will be out for a couple of years.
Did they make it back?
They did,
mm-hmm.
fortunately. So the drummer and I kept it going, and we actually worked as a two-piece drum and bass for a short time. Then we got a bass player, and then things started to morph. The drummer twisted off, and then the bass player that we had hired, he was a guy from Dallas, Billy mm-hmm. Etheridge, and he said, wow, he said, I know a drummer who turned out to be Frank Beard.
Yeah.
Billy Etheridge was more interested. He was focused on, he liked the Hammond B3. He wanted to get away from the bass and go to organ. So he said, I'm going to step down, but Frank knows a guy. It turned out to be none other than Dusty Hill. Little did I know that Frank Beard and Dusty Hill had worked together since they were 14. So I inherited this
tight,
strident rhythm section.
Yeah.
Tight.
Yeah.
And I just walked on. It was a diving board. I said, okay, fine, let's go.
And they were all about the blues.
They were. And it was shortly there. Not the first day it was in an afternoon, and we were gonna try it to see if it was gonna work.
Where'd you do that?
That was we were back in Texas in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And we were gonna do a little 30-minute set.
Yeah.
Well, we started in on a shuffle, a blues shuffle in C. 3 hours later we finally pulled it to the curb. I said, I think this is gonna work. So there's an interesting history of you know, that is the cornerstone. We've tried not to get too far from it.
Well, was it a relief, though? Because, like, I imagine at that time in the mid-60s and hanging out with Jimmy and dealing with the Soft Machine and seeing where music was going, to sort of get back to a shuffle and just fucking, you know, open that thing up, it must have been sort of a relief, and it must have appeared different than what was going on elsewhere.
There was a great book by Paul Oliver called The Story of the Blues.
Yeah.
Still available. It's considered to be the illumination that he brought forth,
uh-huh.
going back to minstrel days in
right.
the 20s.
Right.
Carrying it on right up till that time. That was, you know, late 60s.
Yeah.
And we learned so much. There was Paul Oliver's works. Another Englishman, Tony Russell, was doing some great books.
Documenting. So, so you guys would read about it, and then you'd go get the records?
Yeah.
So which records were the ones that you're like, that's the drive shaft right there?
Well, the benchmark, we still consider Jimmy Reed. There's not a day that starts off without playing a Jimmy Reed number.
The best.
It's so... people say, oh, that Jimmy Reed stuff, that's that easy stuff, until you start understanding the complexity between Jimmy Reed,
yeah.
the second guitarist Eddie Taylor, and the drummer.
Right.
It's all wrong.
Yeah.
And it works.
Right.
And try to figure that out.
Was it him that had a problem with his eyesight or something, that his wife used to have to, you know, transcribe shit, or am I making that up?
No. Mama Reed, as they called her, was always at his side.
Yeah.
And although certain interviews would argue that never happened, that she was present. But clearly there are examples of recordings where you can hear her whispering the words
right.
as it's coming up to
right.
the next line.
Uh-huh.
She'd give him a hint.
So let's go through, I don't usually do this, but I want to go through the records. Can we do it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So the first album, how was that received? ZZ Top's first album. It's out of the gate. What is it, 71, 72?
70.
1970.
Yeah, we started in the latter part of 69.
Yeah.
And then went up to make the first, it was called ZZ Top's first album.
Yep.
Very inventive.
Yeah.
And that was our first... crack out of the box.
Yeah. How was it received?
We had a nice little number called Somebody Else Been Shaking Your
right.
Tree.
Yep.
Which gained some popularity over the airwaves.
And Backdoor Love Affair, you did live on, what was it, the B-side of, was it Tejas or Fandango?
Fandango, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, sure enough.
Yeah. So you brought that one back around.
And my dear buddy from, again, from Houston, who had relocated to Memphis,
mm-hmm.
he called me up long distance and held the phone up to the record player, and he was playing a Peter Green number, the early Fleetwood Mac.
Which one? Which number?
It was off their first record, and it was one of their slower numbers.
Okay.
Which inspired the track that ZZ Top chose to interpret, entitled Just Got Back from Babies,
uh-huh.
which was our first real 6/8 slow blues number.
Uh-huh.
And the good, I think that the first album is indicative of what was percolating all along.
Right.
This blues thread
was
tying it all together.
Right, but now that I think about it, like, you know, the more you talk about Dusty and about Frank Beard, like that drive, you know, that where they just kind of pushed you out there, and you could just, like, you didn't have to worry about anything.
I could close my eyes and I knew there was solid standing. I didn't have to worry about a thing.
And then on the second record, that you had a hit on that one, didn't you? What was it? Just Got Paid is on the second record, right?
Yes.
On Rio Grande Mud. That's a great record.
Mm.
And that got a little traction, didn't it?
Yeah. By this time, we had just started traveling out of state.
Mm-hmm.
We were tripping over into Louisiana, Mississippi, and thanks to Walter Baldwin,
mm-hmm.
living in Memphis, he was pals with a guy up there, Stedman Matthews. Mm-hmm. And Stedman was kind of a mover and shaker, and he organized a blues gathering at the Overton Park Band Shell. It was a little tiny version of the Hollywood Bowl, outdoor seating.
Yeah.
And he played, in fact, our first record had just been released. Walter got a copy. I sent it up there. He played it for Stedman, and Stedman said, well, you know these guys. Let's put them on the blues show.
Yeah.
And there was Furry Lewis was on the program.
Wow.
Johnny Wood, the famous harmonica player from Memphis.
Furry Lewis must have been 100.
At that time, he was probably.
Yeah.
And Bobby Bland showed up.
Wow.
B.B. King was on the bill.
Uh-huh.
So these were the heavyweight guys.
Right.
And when we came to town, we showed up a couple of days early, and Stedman tripped over. We were staying at the Linden Lodge,
mm-hmm.
Right off of Beale Street, and Stedman dropped over, and Walter called me later. He was rather humored. He said, well, you've created panic. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I understand Stedman paid you a visit. I said, yeah, very nice guy. We're really excited about this appearance.
Yeah.
He goes, yeah, but you're white. He's put you on at the tail end. So I was going, okay, yeah, well, whatever.
After these legends.
Yeah. And because when he heard the record, he never questioned it for a moment. He said, oh, yeah, great. Black blues group. Okay, fine,
right.
Fine. But that evening, we really delivered a powerhouse set, and all of the hotshot players around Memphis were in attendance, and they waited around, and we got to meet the lineup of great players.
Guys I would know?
Well, there was the Jim Dickinson, the rest his soul, the great record producer.
Uh-huh.
He had a band called Mudboy and the Neutrons,
uh-huh.
and they were all over the chart. They were doing crazy stuff. Lee Baker was one of the great guitar players. The young white Robert Johnson was—he was on the scene.
Who's that?
He was from Memphis. He was.
His name was Robert Johnson.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had to play.
He had to play.
Yeah.
And it was actually Robert that. He was well connected around town, and he said, you know, there's a guy that you need to meet. And I had decided to stay in Memphis for a couple of days to hang out with Walter and the rest of the
right.
day. And it was Robert that introduced me to a guy, a rather eccentric character named Mike Ladd, who ran a shop called Mike Ladd's Guitar City.
Uh-huh.
It was perched in a strip mall, looking out of his door across Highway 51, staring at Elvis's house.
Right.
Perfect location.
I know that strip mall. Elvis's Uncle Vernon used to sell a book in front, like, it's right across from Graceland, right?
Yeah, well, at the time, it was a cleaner's and a...
Right, but now it's all Elvis stuff.
All Elvis.
Right.
They took it over later, but Mike Ladd is an enigmatic character in that he could be credited with having the foresight to understand what vintage guitars, before that word was even floating around.
Uh-huh.
He knew the value of this magical spot when Gibson, Fender, and the great guitars were being made.
Pre-CBS Fenders?
Yeah.
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 And those old Gibsons from the 50s?
Oh, yeah. And that was the start of it. In fact, Mike Ladd has the distinction. His father was one of the three founding members of Holiday Inn Hotel chain.
Really? So he was he was all right?
Mike Ladd was all right. He was well-heeled and had a pocket full of change, and all he wanted to do was hang out with guitars and the guys that played them.
Oh, that's fun.
So, in fact, he and I went to the Gibson Guitar Factory in Kalamazoo, Michigan. This was 72.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time... Robert came back on the scene. He said, you know, you guys make really good music. You've got two records behind you. I think if you would give Memphis a shot, you could up the ante on making great sounding records. You make great sounding music. Let's make great sounding records.
And so that's where you went for Tres Hombres?
Yes. We had already recorded the tracks in Texas, but I was persuasive enough to... give it a try. I've got the management to say, well, let's go check this out.
What made the difference?
I was insistent because Robert and Walter and so many of the musicians.
But you already laid down the track, so you're bringing master tapes to Memphis?
To mix.
Okay.
So they were still in a pretty raw form. But Led Zeppelin had just done Led Zeppelin III in Memphis.
Right.
And they had Terry Manning and Joe Hardy, and it was the Memphis music scene was still quite robust. Stax was still going.
Right.
Isaac Hayes, of course, was leading the charge, and so many of the great Stax artists were still.
Yeah, I had Booker T in here once.
Yeah.
For a couple hours.
The guy.
Yeah, he's the guy. Yeah.
And that first experience in Memphis led to the release of what we know as Tres Hombres, which had LaGrange.
That was the big one.
Waiting for the Bus, Jesus Just Left Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was great.
Is that the one that broke you?
Yeah, that did it. That was our first top 10. Was
LaGrange?
Yeah.
Man.
It sure enough was, man. And we didn't leave Memphis for the next 18 years.
You lived there or you just recorded there? Oh, you stayed there.
Well, we started commuting, and then later I said, you know, it's a long drive. Let's just move in. We moved in. I lived at the Peabody Hotel for a
sure.
while.
Sure. Watch those ducks every day? Is it going to walk the ducks?
Yeah. Mr. Pembroke going to walk the ducks.
So then you just go, so 75, so 73, Tres Hombres, 75, Fandango, 1977, Tejas. I remember being excited when that came out because I was in high school and I was like, holy shit, here it is. It's a good looking cover. Where was that food from in Tres Hombres?
Leo's Mexican Restaurant in Houston.
Yeah.
They're unfortunately, they closed their doors, but while they were going, I said, I know where to get this
picture
statement. Let's get the perception right.
And Tejas was a huge record too, right?
Big one.
Yep.
It was odd in that there was one side that was all studio recordings.
Right.
And the flip side was a live version that we did down in New Orleans.
Really? Or was that Fandango? I thought the live
one... Oh, I'm sorry. You're right.
Right.
Yeah, Fandango.
Yeah. Fandango was, because I remember we'd get in the car, and we put that cassette in, we listened to that whole live side.
Yeah.
What you guys doing? Got me down, got me down, got me down. Like, you... I mean, we drove to that shit.
Yeah.
But then, Tejas was huge, too. I mean, It's Only Love is a great song.
Mm, we still play it.
Do you?
Yeah.
It's great.
The funny thing about that particular track, everybody talks about that, the very start of the track opens with Frank doing a little drum figure. It was rather simplistic, but the sound was bombastic, and it was by accident. The microphone had fallen off the stand, and the microphone head was leaning up against the bass drum head.
It was an accident.
And Frank's bass drum was beating that poor microphone to death, but it was, we couldn't figure out how he was doing it. And later, the engineer came, oh, we may have to do this again. No, leave it.
So then after Tejas and after all those records, you guys are selling, you're doing stadiums, right?
Yeah, it blew up.
Yeah.
It got big. And that was, you know, the start of who could outdo the next guy's production. It was what started off as just, you know, playing and wanting to, you know, play the best you could.
Right.
Then it became kind of this measure of theatrics and
right
and giant.
But you stayed with Terry Manning and the other guys.
Yeah, Joe Hardy, Terry, John Hampton. They were the core. They were the chief engineers.
Right,
and they held sway over they were Studio A and Studio B, and John Fry kind of gave them free hand to keep the focus on just making great sounding music.
So you're saying that the competition was about the show? Or was it about...
Well, when arena rock, remember right, when that sure. term yeah. finally hit the yeah. streets? It was definitely that. It was turning in... I mean, the popularity of live appearances were growing by leaps and bounds, and it was nothing to play a baseball stadium.
Right.
You know, and... Yeah, everything was fine. We did a show in 76, ZZ Top's Barn Dance and Barbecue.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Cocker was on the bill. Santana showed up. Jimmy Page came along with Bad Company. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a pretty it was like 180,000 people shoehorned into University of Texas Stadium.
Right. Is that what the photograph in Tejas is of?
Yes.
Yeah.
They were all pals that, you know, there was still a...
great voice, that guy, Paul Rogers.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And there was still a real friendly exchange between bands. We're kind of mixing and matching.
And right. And you guys closed that thing?
Yes. The heat index was ridiculous.
Right.
But when it was all said and done, Coach Daryl Royal discovered that some... rather zealous fan wanted to take a piece of Texas home and carved out of the AstroTurf a piece in the state the shape of the state of
right.
Texas.
Yeah,
and that didn't sit too well. So that
that was
no
the end
more.
Of it.
That was the
That's
end.
That's all it took.
No more stadium shows there.
So okay. So then you decide on the Beards, and you decide on right. I mean, that was about after DeGuayo, right? That was when. The real show started.
We worked up till the end of 76, which was, you know, bicentennial, and there was a lot of excitement.
Uh-huh.
And we took what was intended to be a 3-month holiday, kept extending and extending. Frank went down to Jamaica. Dusty was hanging out in parts of Mexico. I was over in Europe.
Did everyone keep their shit together? Was there any, like, you know, disasters? Did you almost lose anyone?
Well, we were on the phone just to keep the connection.
Uh-huh.
But we weren't sure what anybody was getting into.
Right.
I'm sure there were some hard left turns on the way. But then we woke up and 3 years had gone by. No personal appearances, no trips to the studio. Now, the interesting, the telltale evidence is to be found on the pullout sleeve of DeGuayo.
Yeah.
We finally got back together. Warner Brothers had stepped forward to hire us.
Right.
And they lured us away from London Records onto Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And when we showed up, the abject laziness was evident. The beards had started.
Right.
Even Frank was in the running.
Right.
He gave up the ghost. Dusty and I had the jump on it.
Right.
So he said, look, I got the name. You guys take it.
Right.
But we went in, resumed our residency there at Arden Studios in Memphis. And I want to say the first track was what you pointed out earlier. And folks, Mark is very astute. He knew that this Dust My Broom track was long overdue.
Right.
And that was the opening track. It was kind of a warm-up thing.
Uh-huh.
Nothing to really...
Right.
But it felt
familiar.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just something to get it going.
Get your swag out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'd learned the Elmore James upstroke technique.
Uh-huh.
You know, he did that da 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 da.
It was all up. Oh, really?
Most of the time.
Uh-huh.
And you know, there's a long running I don't know if it's a joke. It was actuality. That was they said, yeah, Elmore keeps doing that same riff. That's all he knew.
Right. It was enough.
It was enough.
Sure.
He said, yeah, you better enjoy it while you can, because when I'm gone, it's gone.
Right. And Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac, I mean, with Jeremy Spencer, that
now,
was it.
Yeah. There's an exception.
Yeah.
Because Jeremy Spencer could deliver.
Right, right.
He learned it.
He learned it, and he was hung up on it.
And could sing.
Yeah, yeah.
Those two guys, Peter Green and Jeremy Spencer.
So DeGuayo, Dust My Broom, had Cheap Sunglasses. That was a huge hit. I Thank You, that was a huge hit. So the hits keep coming, man. But the production changes.
Yeah. This was still in the day of the big who's got more lights.
Yeah.
Who's got a bigger sound system.
Right.
And that continued on. We did, all the way through. There was DeGuayo, followed with El Loco.
Yeah.
And then...
Eliminator.
Was the biggie, the wild card.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, wow. That's a big one. Holy shit.
Yeah. And I think it was not necessarily thought out or planned, but the general consensus of what goes on at Arden Studio, even today...
Yeah.
There's an openness and a willingness to experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, John Fry was funding all of this newfangled stuff because he was curious.
Technology.
He wanted to stay up with recording, the ways to record and the equipment to capture.
Right. You get sold on the idea that technology is a good thing.
Yes. At that time, it was in full swing.
Right.
Later, the pendulum swung back.
Sure. So what was the technology? What was it like? Frank was still drumming.
Yes. And then Lyndon Hudson, he was a producer and engineer. He was actually living at Frank's house. Mm-hmm. Frank had an extra house on the house, and mm-hmm. Lyndon was there. We built a small studio at Frank's house.
Okay.
And Lyndon brought up the notion of good timing.
Yeah.
Good tuning and good timing. Mm-hmm. And that was such a simplistic notion, but everybody had kind of forgotten about it.
Mm-hmm.
So Frank went to start woodshedding, and we were playing specified tempos, and we were playing with learning how to play with a click track, so we didn't drift. Our habits had gotten so terrible. We when you play on the road as much as ZZ Top played on the road, you start developing this weird muscle memory.
Yeah.
You play the same song seven nights in a row. Well, you start off on Monday, and it's in proper tempo.
Right.
By Sunday of the end of the week, you know it. And the only challenge left is, well, we know how to play it. We can play it, but let's play it faster. And by the end of 6 months, your three-minute song is over in about 40 seconds.
It's punk rock by the time you're done.
Oh, definitely.
So that was really an interesting thing. So this guy says, like, we got to reel this in. You guys got to get your tuning right. You got to get the tempo steady.
Yeah.
And that, it was weird because I think people thought that it was somehow mechanized, but it wasn't. It was just you being diligent.
Well, there and Terry Manning and the whole Joe Hardy Ardent squad, ironically, had the same advantage of figuring out how do we incorporate, let's face it, ZZ Top, they were not a, at the time we weren't really a techno band,
mm-hmm.
but these technological advancements were starting to make their way in. We were experimenters. We didn't know what we were doing necessarily, but that was the good measure was there was never a manual.
Right. And people want, you want people to dance. You wanted to keep up with the pace of what people were into.
Yes.
Right.
Over the airwaves.
Right.
Good sounding records with proper timing.
Right.
Were starting to become the order of the hour.
Right.
There was the discovery. And you know, good timing is nothing more than a factor of trustability.
Right.
When it, let's face it, the guy on the dance floor, his girlfriend drags him out there. He doesn't want to be there.
Yeah.
And the live drummer, if he drops a beat, the guy loses his balance. He falls on the floor and he, you know, he just doesn't dig it. However, the rise of predictably on-time music eliminated that worry.
Mm-hmm.
Because that which is repeatable becomes trustable, and us human condition like to be trusted.
Sure,
something.
Sure, got to know where to put your foot.
Exactly. Yeah. One in front of the other, not on the floor.
So, all right, so you do all those records, and then like things sort of, you know, kind of with Afterburner, Recycler, Antenna, you're still jamming. But at some point, what was it that made you go, like, we got to get back to... We got to do Rhythmine.
The guy in the street kind of called our attention. He forced our hand. The expert from out of town.
Sure.
They thought that they had discovered that we were starting to become too far away from those blues roots.
Uh huh.
And it was a loud voice.
Yeah.
Something to not be ignored.
Uh huh.
And we didn't really have a problem with it. I like playing that bluesy kind of thing.
Yeah.
So back in we get.
Yeah, it's great, man. And Lanford Futura was great. How was that working with Rick Rubin?
Well, he's flying overhead.
Yeah, he's listening now.
He's tuning in.
He doesn't want anyone to say anything. It was pretty stripped down, though. I just listened to it the other day, but it's definitely solid. Was that an interesting experience working with him?
Oh, definitely. Now, I had known Rick socially. We had become pals back in 1980.
Uh-huh.
And believe it or not, I went to a rave at Knott's Berry Farm, of all places.
Uh-huh.
And
you probably fit right in, right?
Well, Rick was working on the Red Hot Chili Peppers project that was underway.
Yeah.
And my little gal friend was friends with Flea and his gal friend. And all of a sudden, there was this big gang load. Let's go to Knott's Berry Farm. It starts at midnight, which was very uncharacteristic for Knott's Berry Farm to be having a raise.
Sure.
But we all went and became fast friends from that night forward. And Rick would periodically, he'd step forward and say, well, I know now's not the time, but don't think that I'm not watching. And sooner or later, hopefully we'll be able to get in, cut it up pretty good.
Well, he's like a curator of authenticity now. He's like, you know, he wants the bare bones of shit.
Yes, he is a realist.
Yeah.
And an economist, if he can get you to do more through less, that is I think it's one of his strong points.
Mm-hmm.
You add that onto his remarkable sense of patience.
Mm-hmm.
No hurry.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, and he can feel it. Mm-hmm. And until he feels it, he'll... One day we were in the studio and Dusty leaned over and he said, hey, you know Rick inside and out. You guys have been pals forever. We've been playing the same song for 3 hours. Do you think you could ask Rick if we're getting somewhere? I said, hey.
He was afraid to ask him?
Yeah. And I said, okay, fine. I looked through the glass. I said, hey, Rick, are we getting anywhere with this? He goes, dude, he said, you guys nailed it in the first 20 minutes. We just like watching you guys play. So, you know, that's Rick. He is so...
What did Dusty say after that?
Well, he could only grin and goes, yeah. Okay. And what made it all work is not only does Rick appreciate music from a performance and recording standpoint, we like playing. So we didn't care.
Yeah.
We said, okay, great.
Are you happy to be back doing that sort of analog thing? I mean, it came out on 45. It came out on 180-gram vinyl. I mean, did you know that was going to happen? Was that your choice?
Again, Rick's vigilance toward what is beyond trendy,
mm-hmm.
but what shows up of value,
mm-hmm.
he's not afraid to make that as an offering. Whether or not it was not designed necessarily.
Right.
We were just having a good time.
And did he do that all on, did you guys record that on analog or you just recorded it regular?
They were doing some of everything.
Uh-huh. Sounds great.
It's great. He doesn't miss a lick. If it sounds good on analog, fine. If it sounds good through some
digital magic machine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It all will go toward one thing, what feels right.
And you're feeling good.
Yeah.
You're having a good time.
Oh, it was great. We would commute. It was a way to get me out of Hollywood, out to Malibu.
Mm-hmm.
It was about an hour commute.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just enough to, driving along PCH and kind of chilling out and just getting in a space that made a lot of sense.
And how'd you get hooked up with Josh Homme on that tune on his last album? Because he was thrilled he came over here and I interviewed him and I was playing ZZ Top when he walked in.
Oh, awesome.
And he was like, oh, Billy played on my song. And he said, you hit a harmonic with your beard.
Yeah, that was true. Yeah, the beard was dangling over the strings little, and I was bearing down.
Yeah.
We were getting it. He's not only a wonderful, and talented individual, he has surrounded himself with remarkable players.
Yeah.
And they all hold dear that notion of doing it fiercely.
Yeah.
Our first encounter, he was wanting to do a cover of an early ZZ Top song called Precious and Grace.
Mm-hmm.
And they were struggling with the middle break. And he tracked me down and he said, hey, man, we're over here in Burbank. Can you come over? And I said, sure, man. What you got on? He said, well, this Precious and Grace thing has us on the ropes. I said, you guys? I said, come on, man. And he said, well, but I knew we were destined to become longstanding buddies. Inside that studio was an array of the strangest, weirdest, unheard of gear.
Yeah.
They're all gearheads, man. Uh-huh. They had the weirdest, wildest stuff.
Like what?
Well, Josh said, you know, we're just beginning to learn our heroes from the 50s, the blues guys that we attempt to interpret.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have money to buy the expensive Fender or Gibson guitars. These were Silvertone, Harmony.
K's. Yeah.
The kind of the...
Sears guitars.
I mean, they were good instruments.
Sure.
Just more affordable. And that's what a lot of that stuff... And they do have a distinctive sound.
Mm-hmm.
Same goes with the amps. They didn't have the Showmans and the Bassmans. And they had Alamo... the Challengers and stuff.
Maybe a Champ.
Maybe.
Yeah.
At best.
Yeah.
so they have made it a point to create interesting sounds with the unpredictable instruments.
Wow.
It's an array. We were talking, James Harmon, another buddy of ours. James is a great blues harmonica blower.
Yeah.
James has worked with us on ZZ Top Records many times. And early on, James worked with Walter Shaky Horton.
Yeah.
They did a blues duet tour. And James was laughing because as kind of a curious, really dedicated and interested guy, when they'd come back to they shared hotel room. And James said, yeah, I used to ask questions. In fact, I learned that I was asking too many questions. And I said, how so? And he said, well, every night, you know, I'd say, well, what was it like in Chicago? What was it like down in Mississippi? What was it like in Memphis? Mm-hmm. And one night, Walter turned to James and he said, you know, James, you're a curious man. You're always asking questions. He said, and there's a few things that you don't really know about me. James said, what would that be? And he said, you know Roy Rogers? And James looked at him kind of quizzically. He said, you mean the cowboy, the movie star? He said, yeah, Roy Rogers. He said, yeah, I know Roy Rogers. What about Roy Rogers? He said, well, you know his famous horse? He said, you mean Trigger?
Yeah.
He said, yeah, Trigger. He said, well, what about it? He goes, I train Trigger. James, at that point, he shrunk down, realizing, okay, no more questions. He said, I've just learned it. But Walter Horton told him, he said, one of the interesting asides, when Walter got to Chicago, he was knocking around, and he finally landed a job at one of the local taxi services in Chicago.
Yeah.
And he worked his way up to helping the dispatcher. And the reason that he was so strident and stuck it out until he got that position is he knew that during the dispatcher shift change,
yeah,
if he took some wire cutters, he cut that wire and he'd have a microphone to blow his harmonica through.
Is that where that type of microphone started being used as a harmonica mic? I mean, because it's like what's that mic they use for those harmonic? That's a big old, you know, that one that they...
The Green Bullet. Turner made one, Shure made one. Little Walter is credited with, you know, first taking the Mississippi saxophone, as they called it, and amplification, you know. He
Juke.
Oh, the best.
Great. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Really good stuff. You want to play that guitar?
Yeah. Let me break this thing out. I got to retrench back to a favorite.
What?
Was originally heard from the hand of Ry Cooder. His was a mandolin version, but I think we can get through it. I'll sing you the true song of Billy the Kid. I'll sing on the record of deeds that he did. Way out in New Mexico a long time ago, when a man's best friend was his own 44. And now when Billy the Kid was a very young lad in old Silver City, he went to the bat way out west with a knife in his hands. At the age of 12 years, he killed his first man. Yeah. Fair Mexican maidens play guitars and sing. They sing the songs about Billy, their boy bandit king. Before this young manhood, had reached his set and he'd not stoned his pistol for 21 years. It was on one black night that poor Billy died. He said to his friends, I'm not satisfied. There's 21 men I've put bullets through, and Sheriff Pat Garrett's gonna make 22. Well, this is how Billy the Kid, he met his fate. A big moon was shining and I was getting late. Shot down by Pat and Garrett, Silver City's best friend. The poor outlaw's life has reached a sad end.
Unbelievable. Thank you so much for talking to me, Billy. It was a real honor.
Awesome, man. Mark, thank you so much, man.
How fucking amazing did that sound? So simple, so sweet. And to hear that voice that we're all so familiar with over so many years, that unproduced. Just two mics in here, buddy. Just two mics in here, people. That was an SM7 next to his mouth and an Encore, a Blue Encore 200 on that little guitar. God damn it, that was fun. Great meeting that guy. He gave me a pick. I got it right here. I got a pick. Thick-ass pick, man. So look, folks, that's it. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Check the calendar. I am going to be touring a bit with the Oddball Festival, doing a little 15-minute spot in some cities. Got some other gigs coming up in Bloomington. I got some a gig coming up in Charlotte, Kansas City, St. Louis is sold out. But stuff's going on. Go to WTFpod.com, check the calendar, check the episode guide, get the free app, upgrade to premium, stream all that stuff for a few bucks extra. Thank you, Chicago. Thanks for coming out. That was fun. It was a big night for me, man. Had a lot of realizations. I'm on the precipice. I'm on the precipice of big change. I'm on the precipice of letting go of the struggle, of the panic, of the cycle, and just doing the work. Is that possible? Now I'm second guessing it. Now I don't even know what I'm talking about. Boomer lives!